From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're always thankful for you. We are always grateful for your support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday is the Christian feast of St. David of Wales. It's also the end of the Baha'i intercalary days, with Wednesday bringing the start of the Baha'i 19-day fast. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, oh my, the primary and caucus voting prior to this weekend has continued to bring good news for Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. One surprise was for Ted Cruz, who came in third in South Carolina despite the intensely evangelical reputation of the GOP electorate there. Super Tuesday on March 1st, we'll see polling in 12 states. That will be interesting. Abortion may still be legal in this country, but Bloomberg reports that years of efforts to restrict access are bearing fruit now. 2015 saw facilities vanishing at the highest rate since the Roe v. Wade ruling in 1973. On Tuesday, President Obama took steps toward fulfilling a long-deferred promise to close Guantanamo Bay. Naturally, opponents reacted with everything from scaremongering to accusations that the president wants to hurt America, and conservatives vowing to ignore any nominee to the Supreme Court can no longer be called the most extreme. Now, that title goes to several prominent voices demanding that the late Justice Antonin Scalia's anticipated vote on pending cases be counted. That's right. They want his rulings even from the grave. Well, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
We might suggest that the Christian right has offered an evangelical social teaching tradition. But who would really suggest that the scattered speeches and pamphlets and books of Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and James Dobson offer a usable, substantive social teaching tradition that has 21st century staying power?
There's no question that religion, in particular conservative Christianity, has played an outsized role in this presidential campaign so far. Worse yet, theologian David Gushee argues that a big part of that role is actually contrary to the values Christianity teaches. His recent Religion News Service column is headlined, "Trump Cruz Popularity Represents Two Very Different Christian Failures." And David Gushee will be back with us on this week's show.
We've got all these people going blah, blah, blah about how this was founded as a Christian nation, but it wasn't founded as a Christian nation, although we were overwhelmingly a majority Christian people.
With a number of global crises driven by religious conflicts today, it's particularly important to consider the long history of religion's power to both divide and unite. Best-selling author and free thinker Susan Jacoby has risen to that challenge with the just-released new book, Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion. We will see if there have been any lessons learned when Susan joins me later in the show. But first,
take a stand against religious bigotry and intolerance, and for those brave heroes who have lost their livelihoods and their positions of honor by standing for faith.
Energized by backlash to the progress LGBT rights have made at the federal level, and by incessant fear-mongering from the religious right, more and more state governments are working on so-called religious freedom restoration legislation. And never mind that most of these bills either duplicate long-standing constitutional protections or else trample both civility and decency by creating long lists of allowable forms of discrimination. Along the way, they create unlawful protected classes and false equivalences between genuine unfairness and the desire of some to live in a nation that supplants the notion of tolerance and coexistence with absolutist deference to an ever-growing list of, quote, deeply held religious beliefs. Worst of all, these newfound rights to discriminate are often extended not only to individuals and religious institutions, but to all kinds of organizations and businesses as well. Joining me now is Eunice Rowe, Advocacy and Policy Counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union. Eunice, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Let's start with a little history. For years, the ACLU was a supporter of the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 and even filed legal briefs leaning on that legislation. So what happened? What is it in recent years that has changed?
The original Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act of 1993 was enacted as a result of a case called Employment Division versus Smith, where two Native American believers out of the state of Oregon were penalized for smoking peyote as part of their religious ritual. They were fired from their jobs and denied unemployment benefits, and they sued over that as a violation of their religious beliefs. And Justice Antonin Scalia, who has recently passed, wrote that opinion called Employment Division versus Smith, saying, well, the law criminalizing peyote is not targeting any religious beliefs. It's neutral, and therefore this is not considered a burden. So in reaction to that, there was a wide bipartisan multi-state effort that led to the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The ACLU was a prominent member of that coalition. And then there was a follow-up law at the federal level in 1999 called the Religious Liberty Protection Act. It would have extended the federal RFRA's application to states. To clarify, the original 1993 federal RFRA really applied only to federal laws and policies. And so the ROPA, the 1999 law, was an attempt to extend its reach into states and localities. And the ACLU spoke up during that time with the same consistent principle with which we're objecting to the spread of RFRAs in the states now, which is there are different protections, especially against discrimination at state and local levels, that are broader and more protective than the federal. And if you extend the RFRA's reach into state, it could put those laws in jeopardy. In particular, in the late 90s, the laws that, or cases that we highlighted were instances in which commercial landlords did not want to rent to unmarried heterosexual couples. That would have been in violation of some of the housing statutes on the books, both in states and localities. And so we cited those cases as a reason why the ROPA, the RFRA's extension into states, should not be permitted. And so, you know, our concerns about civil rights, making sure that religion cannot be used to discriminate or harm against anybody else, has been consistent. And then, of course, the recent Hobby Lobby ruling, which really exposed how RFRA can be used to undermine other people's rights, heightened our concerns that much more.
There's plenty of confusion about both the need for and the nature of the state-level RFRAs that we've seen in the past couple of years. Would you talk about the trend in drafting these laws and where that came from?
We started seeing an uptick in state RFRA legislation in the early part of this decade. It's been continuing upward steadily. And, you know, we raised concerns at the state levels as well. The ACLU, as you pointed out earlier, uses RFRA to protect the rights of religious believers. You know, one of our recent cases was on behalf of a Sikh student looking to join the ROTC, and there are prohibitions on his religious garb. So we use the RFRA to challenge that. We want to protect religious exercise, too. We just do not want this to be used to jeopardize anybody else's rights or harm anybody else. We have suggested language to that effect in some states. You know, there's summarily voted down, all the while the proponents of these laws are trying to tell us, oh, we have no intention of discriminating. That is not how we think about religious rights. And so we say, great, we're in agreement. Let's put that into the law. And that kind of language is almost always rejected. And so it has consistently raised our suspicions, not to mention many of the proponents of these laws, unfortunately, both in the legislature and among advocacy organizations, are widely known both to be anti-choice and anti-LGBT. And so, obviously, you know, we want to be as careful as possible when drafting these kinds of bills.
Eunice, some people will say all of this is just about LGBT rights. Is that true, or are there even broader implications as well?
I'm so glad you raised this question. I mean, the rhetoric often falls on LGBT people, but the actual impact of these laws are so much broader. And I want to point out some of the more egregious laws. There are just so many bills in the 2016 state legislative sessions. I was counting earlier, in over 30 states, over 100 bills. You know, this is just rising in volume from previous years. Some of these bills would, for instance, allow adoption and foster care placement agencies that are receiving state funds to discriminate based on religious grounds. Surely they are targeting LGBT people, but as you can imagine, that could also affect people who are unmarried, prospective parents who may be of different religion than the agencies. And so it allows for discrimination against a host of qualified parents, all at the expense of children who need loving homes. And I think that is the most offensive part of all. There are other bills that would allow for licensed counselors to deny treatment or allow them to refuse accepting certain kinds of clients based on their own religious beliefs. And because of the variability in people's religions, it really is not just about LGBT people, despite the rhetoric. It can affect a host of very vulnerable populations who need these services.
The ACLU has an incredibly comprehensive resource on its website laying out the status of these bills in each state. We will link to that from our website, but would you highlight two or three states that are of most concern right now?
Sure. One such state is Missouri. They have introduced a host of potential constitutional amendments that would allow organizations of all kinds, businesses, individuals, religious organizations, including, as I mentioned, foster care adoption agencies, to discriminate based on their beliefs on marriage. And the state can't deny these discriminatory people or agencies money. This would be, it would result in taxpayer-funded discrimination. And this would go on the ballot for popular vote. You know, we are, of course, hopeful that the public will be educated and will see these for what they are, but that is always a risk going to the public on these types of issues, especially when our other side can obfuscate by claiming that this just protects religious freedom. Mm-hmm. There are many states that are trying to introduce multiple bills that will allow for discrimination. They usually focus on just one, but try to spread our resources and our opposition by trying so many different vehicles. And states that fit that description include, you know, Mississippi, Missouri, Georgia, Oklahoma. These states have introduced a wide range of bills, you know, protecting discrimination from adverse consequences from the government. And, of course, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act is moving fairly quickly in the state of West Virginia.
Eunice, this is so often painted as a life or death struggle between people of faith and those who would dismiss and denigrate that faith. Obviously, the reality is much more complicated. Are there faith groups that are working with the ACLU to retain the kind of discrimination disguised as religious freedom?
Yes, people of faith from across the country who don't agree with this misleading interpretation of what religious freedom really entails have such an important role to play in this discourse, and we've been engaging with people across all faith denominations. We have a working group that we convene on a regular basis to discuss what bills are moving quickly, how they can plug in, and their voices are so important. You know, they can talk with authority about what religious freedom really means, why their faith does not allow their religious beliefs to be used to harm anybody else. And they carry that credibility speaking from, you know, their expert position on their religion.
Eunice Rowe is Advocacy and Policy Counsel at the American Civil Liberties Union. The ACLU has an incredibly comprehensive online resource tracking the ways that a number of states are trying to enshrine discrimination into law. We will link to it from stateofbelief.com. Eunice, thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Susan Jacoby is a leading public intellectual, an atheist, author, and activist. No stranger to the New York Times bestseller list, her books tend to galvanize the conversation around the topics she chooses to discuss. Earlier this month, Susan released her latest book titled Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion. And I'm delighted that it brings Susan Jacoby back to State of Belief Radio. Susan, welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be back.
You know, I really do like this book. It is a sweeping history, and I couldn't help but think, what in the world made you want to take on such a challenge?
Oh, that is a really good question. Believe you me, I've asked myself that also. This book represents 6 years of research. I did limit it to Western civilization, however.
I noticed.
And, you know, it starts in the early Christian era and really extends through today. And what I'm interested most in, I tried to focus on times and places where the three great monotheistic religions converged, mm-hmm. and also times like the early Christian era, the Reformation, the Inquisition, in which large numbers of people of one faith converted to another, mm-hmm. At the same time that major political changes were taking place. What I think interested me is, as you know, I'm an atheist, and what has always interested me about conversion, and I also come from a family with a lot of converts in it, as I describe, but I've always been fascinated, one, by, let's say, a Jew who believes that Jews are still waiting for the Messiah, wakes up one morning and decides that Jesus is the Messiah, or mm-hmm. vice versa. And what I've always thought is, I wouldn't for a moment deny the emotional factors, the spiritual factors in many conversions. I think when you get into eras of mass conversion, there are other factors that also enter into it. Mm-hmm. Everything from the worst end of the spectrum, force, to what we have in America, which is the very friendly persuasion of intermarriage and going to school together with people of different faiths. And as priests and rabbis and ministers 80 years ago warned, when you put people in public schools of different faiths at an age when they're getting interested in members of the opposite sex, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you get a lot of interreligious romances.
Yeah.
And they do lead to conversions. It doesn't mean that these are not sincere conversions, but it means that they don't follow the Saul on the road to Damascus model of hitting your head, hearing the voice of God, and just waking up born anew.
Susan, let me ask you, because I'm very interested in your observations about compulsory conversion. I found that very compelling. Will you talk about that?
Compulsory conversion encompasses, I think, more than we think of. I think what most of us think of as the compulsory conversion is the Inquisition. You know, somebody says, convert or die. I mean, obviously, that's compelled. But there is another kind of conversion which isn't that way, in which the convert feels an overwhelming, as they have described it themselves. And by the way, we don't know how many of these there are, because all we know about it are from the few people historically who've written about it.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, Dr. Powell, the head of the National Institutes of Health, C.S. Lewis, people writing about reaching a point where they felt that the pull of faith was so strong that they were being said, as in the Latin in the story in Luke from the Bible, compelle entrare, compel them to come in. Mm-hmm. That, in other words, the pull of faith was so strong that it was an overwhelming force. Mm-hmm. I think that there's been, because people who are masters and mistresses of language write about conversion this way, I think that we have thought that all conversions were like that, when in fact, a lot of them, there are many other more mundane factors involved. In 1918, my grandmother, Broderick, married my grandfather. She was a daughter of German Lutheran immigrants. She converted to Catholicism. Now, this is completely unremarkable in today's America. But then it was a big deal, as you know very well.
Yeah.
Protestantism to Catholicism. And I talked to my grandmother about it years later, and she said, well, she said, really, it's all the same God. Gee, wouldn't it be nice if everybody had that idea? When you think about people killing each other over definitions of the Holy Trinity and so on. Mm-hmm. She said, it's all the same God, and it made your gramps' mother happy. In other words, I cannot see my grandmother, the best person in the world, her conversion was what the nuns of my childhood used to call conversions of convenience. Mm-hmm. It seemed sensible to adopt the same religion as her husband. Yeah. She didn't care very much about the many theological differences between Lutheranism and Catholicism. Mm-hmm. And I think in countries like America, where there's a lot of mingling between, and much more, even more so today than then, far more so today than men, there are a lot of conversions like that. Now, at the moment, I'm getting a lot of criticism for saying this, as though I'm downgrading the spiritual nature of conversions. I'm not. What I'm saying in this book is that there are many kinds of conversions, depending on the circumstances in which people find themselves.
I want to read from the introduction to your book. For purposes of this book, I define genuine conversion, whatever its mixture of spiritual, intellectual, and pragmatic motives, as any change of faith that requires a substantial change in the way a person lives. A conversion is any shift of belief that significantly alters the course of life. I love that definition, and you talk about it as an experience that can be described within atheism or within Judaism or within any ism that one has. And I'd like for you to talk about that for a minute.
Well, actually, I don't think atheism is a religion, and I don't think most people who become atheists, I don't think it resembles the conversion experience at all. Mm-hmm. I think mostly when people just abandon religion, it's more of a slipping away. I don't think, for instance, that there was any real change in the way I lived when I realized that I didn't believe in God. In other words, I think I would have become a writer anyway. I wouldn't have been so drawn to subjects like this, except, and this is really important, if atheism is linked with an ideology which requires the same obedience, compelle entrare, if you will, requires the same non-testing against evidence as a traditional Orthodox religion, then it is like a conversion. And the best example of it, known to all of us, which I do discuss in the book, is the attraction of many Western intellectuals to Stalinist communism in the 1920s and 30s. Stalinism was a religion, not because communists are atheists, but because Stalinism was a form of politics that demanded the kind of mindless allegiance that many religions used to in the past, the kind of mindless allegiance that radical Islamists and theocracies demand today.
Susan, what can we learn from looking at the history of religious conformity and enforced doctrine that would help us deal with some of the things that we're seeing in the world today? Or is all of this somehow too powerful to hold back?
I'll tell you one thing I learned from writing this book. I'm often very critical of the United States, but one of the things I'm learning learned in all matters of religion. You say this, I've said this on your program before, we were the first country in the world to be founded not on divine authority, but on the rights of man, that there's no mention of God in the Constitution. I've said that, but when you look at conversion here, and how much tolerance there was for it, even when there was much more religious prejudice than there is now, you understand that we started out with something great. And one of the things to me that's absolutely sickening is we're not looking at our own past. When people like Donald Trump talk about keeping Muslims out of the country and all of that kind of thing, they're not looking at the best of our own past, at the best argument we have to make against these thugs. On the other hand, I am not one of these people who says, and this is also what you learn from the history of forced conversion. I did a piece for the New York Times about a year ago called The First Victims of the First Crusade. And it was about how in the First Crusade at the end of the 1096, the Crusaders on their way to liberate the Holy Land from Muslims, they practiced on the Jews of Europe in the Rhineland on their way there, killed them, gave them the choice of converting or dying. And one of the things that was striking to me is the contemporary Hebrew and Christian chronicles both, what they described, the convert or die ultimatum, and what was done to people about taking their money and then killing them anyway, it could have been ripped straight out of the headlines of what was going on with radical Islamist terrorists in the Middle East. So I don't think that to say that this kind of thing, and also the repression and jailing and prisons and lashing of free-thinking bloggers, not religious, in places like Saudi Arabia, killing of them by terrorist free-thinkers in places like Bangladesh, that forced conversion is always an instrument of subjection. And what we're looking at, it's not that most Muslims are terrorists. It's that this form of persecution of other religions, of Muslims who don't agree with them, and of freethinkers and atheists, it reflects a form of Islam stuck with their minds in the 8th century. To say that terrorism has nothing to do with a form of Islam is as ridiculous as saying that the Crusades had nothing to do with a Christianity as it was at the time. And we have to think of this. We can't think of this in a way. Freedom of conscience is one standard. It's for all people. It's for Muslims who dissent from what terrorists in the Middle East are doing. It's for Muslims who dissent from the way Saudi Arabia treats free thinkers and atheists and women. It is for everyone. And talking about religion as though it's always good and nothing can ever be done bad in the name of religion is just wrong.
Susan Jacoby is program director of the New York branch of the Center for Inquiry, a popular public speaker. She is the New York Times bestselling author of numerous important books, including the seminal The Age of American Unreason. Susan's latest is titled Strange Gods, A Secular History of Conversion. And you can see Susan speaking at Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. on March 8th. Susan, we didn't have enough time. We got to get together again. But thank you for being with us today on State of Belief.
Thank you.
The Reverend Dr. David Gushee is a leading voice on issues of ethics and religion in this country. He's a prolific author. He holds distinguished faculty positions at Mercer University and serves as vice president of the American Academy of Religion and president-elect of the Society of Christian Ethics. So when his recent commentary, Trump Cruz popularity represents two very different Christian failures, was published by Religion News Service, it got a great deal of attention, and it prompted me to call David Gushee and ask him if he would come back and be with us again on State of Belief, and he said yes, thankfully. So, David, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back with you, Welton.
These are strong words, and I know you don't use strong words lightly. So from your perspective, what are the failures that you see playing out in this election?
Well, there's so many. Where do we start? What I said in my article was that Cruz's campaign was premised on essentially the Christian right strategy that has dominated that part of Christendom since the 70s. And, you know, he was having some success with it, though even since I wrote the column, he appears to be fading a little bit. But, you know, a focus on abortion and homosexuality, make America Christian again, a strong appeal to fight back against secularism and liberalism and all of that. So I said that's a failure partly because of the very, very limited moral vision that it has always represented. Mm-hmm. But it's a, you might call it garden variety by now, in that we've seen it before.
Mm-hmm.
I think Trump is a very different kettle of fish. I consider the support that some Christians are giving Trump a more radical failure because of the nature of a lot of the things that he has said and the way he has presented himself in this campaign.
Mm-hmm. In your article, it's very helpful as well as interesting. You talk about an inoculation that would make it harder for evangelical Christians specifically to support Donald Trump. Please talk about that.
I think my political vision has been decisively shaped by spending many years studying the rise of fascism in Germany and Italy and right-wing politics in Europe during the 20s and 30s, and the way in which politicians were able to appeal to the baser, more racist, nativist, nationalist, xenophobic kinds of tendencies, fears, and passions of people, most of whom were also self-identified Christians in those countries. In other books, I use the language of inoculated Christians in places like Germany in 1929 or 1932. Some of them were inoculated in the sense that they would listen to somebody like a Hitler and they would say, no way. There's no way support for this person is compatible with the Christian faith that I hold dear. But many, many other Christians, they didn't get the shot. You know, they didn't get the inoculation or it didn't take. And so the elements that were attractive at that moment in the passions of the era kind of overrode the Christian convictions that should have helped them stand firm. Mm-hmm. It's the contrast between a Dietrich Bonhoeffer on the one hand and like the German Christian movement on the other in pre-Nazi and Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
I am not making a direct comparison, but what I'm just saying is the Christian faith, it doesn't necessarily yield any single political vision, but it ought to kind of set some parameters of this kind of person and these kinds of policies are generally in the ballpark, yes, versus no, this kind of person or these kinds of policies are not in the ballpark. They're just ruled out by what it means to be a follower of Jesus. And that's what I was trying to say. I think that's what worries me about at least the worst moments of Donald Trump's campaign, things he has said, ways he has presented himself, the comments about Muslims, about immigrants, the tone of his rallies, things like saying from a platform, I'd like to punch him in the face, you know, about a person who was protesting. That kind of demeanor, the violent spirit, I just don't see how Christians' intuitive sense wouldn't just recoil and say, no. No matter what else might be attractive about this person, this crosses the line. There are many Christians who are responding that way. They're getting it, that there's a problem, but there are altogether too many who are not.
In your mind, is this manipulation, I sometimes call it prostitution of religion, more serious this time than it has been in past elections?
I would say that the appeal to the Christian right voters, an appeal to nostalgia, an appeal to we're going to turn back the tides of liberalism and so on, kind of garden variety religious appeals. I get it. It speaks to a lot of people who are not happy with Supreme Court decisions and the gay rights movement and abortion and so on. It it's just been in the air for 40 years. Nobody has ever gotten elected on that to the presidency on that platform, mm-hmm. but it's just been kind of part of the coalition. I think that what Trump is doing is not really a blatant religious appeal, though when he tried, like at Liberty, it was kind of laughable.
Yeah.
But it's more of it's an appeal to the baser part of human emotion and a certain kind of American mentality right now at this particular moment that overrides a deeper kind of religious commitment and kind of sweeps everything in its wake,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so it's a very different kind of challenge. I mean, the people I would have the greatest problem with would be trained Christian ministers and other leaders who would look at the entire package that we have in front of us with Donald Trump and say, that's the guy we should support. That is a problem, of very serious problem from my perspective. What I think Mr. Trump is doing is in a sense, overriding the finer religious impulses of a lot of his listeners and projecting toughness and want to take the fight to the enemies and kind of a ruthlessness and even sometimes a cruelty towards like his adversaries on stage, as well as what he says about national adversaries,
mm-hmm.
that the people find exciting or attractive or titillating or seductive as much as anything.
David, I'm curious, how do you respond to the argument, say, of the president of Liberty University, who says we're tired of the Republicans losing on all of these moral values that are of most importance to us, and so this time around we decided not to look at someone who is overtly religious so much as someone who helps build a nation in which religion can be restored to what it should be again?
Yeah, and the one thing that Donald Trump has done in that direction is basically to say, "Hey, I'm not a social conservative Christian right candidate, but I'll protect you people." Basically,
mm-hmm.
remember when he said that? I'll look out for you. Christianity mm-hmm. will be protected, and maybe for some people that's enough. But it's funny, Peggy Noonan, a conservative columnist for Wall Street Journal, very gently asked in a column last week about Donald Trump, is he at all a good man?
Hmm.
And is he fully stable?
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the Wall Street Journal. That's very, very interesting. I mean, just basic moral goodness, disciplined character, verbal self-control, control of anger and temper, capacity to overcome frustration or not to hold grudges. I don't know. The fact that we have somebody who so clearly does not exhibit any of those virtues to be the leading candidate right now on the Republican side, I think takes us into a different area. It's more like the appeal of a strong man, like in Latin American situations where democracy is crumbling or weak, and so you elect a strong man who is going to be tough and restore order and rule of law or the nicer virtues set aside for the toughness and the authoritarian kind mm-hmm. of rule that we need right now. That's the kind of the neighborhood that I think we find mm-hmm. ourselves in, and that's why I wrote the piece that I did. I saw something this week that said that probably the best predictor of support for Donald Trump right now is a kind of an authoritarian tendency or support for authoritarian tendencies, and that's very, very different from the garden variety Christian right message.
Yeah.
That's why I'm very worried about it.
David, we're both ethicists of Christian ethics. We have concerns about the character of our nation.
Yeah.
Where does the kind of reasoning that we're getting from Donald Trump and the kind of rhetoric that we're hearing from him, what kind of impact does that have on our nation?
What I think it does, I mean, I have not gone to a Trump event yet, partly because I would hesitate to even see what it's actually like. But from every news report that I have read about Trump events, especially mm-hmm. as his candidacy has taken off, the level of anger,
mm-hmm.
passion, emotion is apparently quite profound. What it says latent, very intense anger and frustration on the part especially of a certain sector of Americans, overwhelmingly white, many male, more male than female, and many inclining to be on the low end of the educational scale and probably then on the low end of economic well-being, relatively speaking. So what he's doing is he's tapping into the frustrations of that sector, which is a lot of people mm-hmm. in America, and he's giving permission for more blatant expressions of their frustration mm-hmm. to be released, as in beating people up at rallies or the certain kind of rhetoric. And I think he himself has been, to some extent, surprised and to some extent inflamed by discovering the impact he can have on those audiences. Mm-hmm. And I think he's getting a charge out of it, and so the more it goes on, I think the more risk that he's going to cross even more lines and inflame even more deeply. So I'd say a vulgarization, a coarsening, a deepening of violent speech and violent spirit, and an empowering of a lot of people to feel a little more authorized to move in that direction in their attitudes and in their actions. Mm-hmm. It makes me shudder to think of risks to people of color who mm-hmm. might happen to be targeted, or to Muslims, or to people who look like they might be Muslims, mm-hmm. or anybody who would oppose. I also have noticed the way that the anti-media or anti-elite media trope has been hit, and I read a report this past week of some violent cursing of people back in the media section at his rallies. Let's just say I would not at all be surprised if somebody gets hurt
yeah.
or killed coming out of one of these rallies if this continues in the next few months.
Mercer University is located, one the main campus, in Macon, Georgia, and Macon is in South Georgia. David, if you walked out of your office and went downtown to get a New Way hot dog, and someone's heard your critique, would they likely appreciate it and agree with it, or would the person on the street say, you're just prejudiced and this is just partisan stuff?
Well, I guess we'll see on March 1st, won't we?
Yes.
Mr. Trump evokes strong emotions on both sides.
Yeah.
I know many, many, many lifelong Republicans who say that under no circumstance will they support Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So his appeal is not universal. But where it's strong, it's very strong.
Yeah.
So,
Well, let me ask you one more question before we get off. How do you suggest that voters who are influenced by their faith, which is the majority of American voters, how do you counsel them to avoid having that faith be manipulated in their own minds?
I say, on the one hand, when anybody starts dropping religious language, when any politician starts dropping religious language into a campaign speech, mm-hmm. always remember that they are trying to get your vote. It's never, this person is not a pastor, this person is not a Sunday school teacher, they are a politician trying to get your vote, and remind people of the long history of the use and abuse of religious language for electoral purposes, you know. So just be aware of that and never be surprised. And that's Democrats and Republicans. Anybody who uses religious talk in America knows that they do so because it might benefit them, even if they also happen to believe it. I think that I would urge all Christians to think about things like character, the overall visible character of a person, which is exhibited in 100 different ways, you know, through what they say and the policies they present and the way they deal with adversity and how they handle pressure and how, you know, what they do in debates and so on, campaign tactics. So look at character. And then look at policy proposals in terms of how they line up with the concern of the entire scripture for those on the margins, for those who lack power, and for those who are beat up, and ask what lines up, you know, what are we hearing? And then, I think this is not really a religious consideration, though maybe a wisdom consideration, the basic readiness of a person to occupy the office for which they are aspiring. I wouldn't want somebody working on my car who didn't have auto mechanic training, or flying a plane who didn't know how to be a pilot, nor would I want somebody as president who didn't have the basic background for it. So, I mean, there's a lot to consider, but I really think in many ways the soul of our country is being both exposed and in some ways worsened right now. But there's a chance to push back. There's a chance to say no. To say, no, this is not who we want to be. And we'll see. We'll see whether we do that.
The Reverend Dr. David Gushee is Distinguished University Professor of Christian Ethics and Director of the Center for Theology and Public Life at Mercer University. He's the author or editor of 20 books and a leading voice for a more progressive evangelical Christianity. His Religion News Service article headlined, "Trump Cruz Popularity Represents Two Very Different Christian Failures," has been widely circulated, and for good reason. David, as always, you helped us with the conversation today, and we always appreciate you being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks for having me on. Take care, Walton.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, good for you, and I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online, too. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and engage in the discussion. You will enjoy it. You'll benefit from it, as will others. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Almost every week, I think it can't get any more exciting than it was this week, but it's likely to happen again. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.